Accession number 27185, reel 58.
Major Barras, reel 58. I think you were saying you were at the depot at Morley. You had to report there, having
yes.
come back from Jamaica.
Yes, I think that was the first place. Well, we must have stayed in a hotel somewhere, I think, to start with for a night.
Yes.
And then got to Morley probably the next morning, where again we were probably put up in a local hotel for a short time whilst I went through all the paperwork and everything there. And whilst I discovered that I'd been put down for a company commander's course at the School of Infantry. Now, I think that's probably a hangover for when it was thought I was going through to
Korea.
It would have been earlier, of course, the company commander's course. Obviously, Paul Clementi-Smith, the CEO of the 1st Essex at that time, I thought, well, Otis eating out in the Caribbean, lying on beaches all that time, I'd become unbattle-worthy, so I send him on a course and get him back to reality again.
Do you think you had got soft physically?
No,
soft
not a bit.
While you
no,
were in
no, not, no, not a bit actually. I mean, it's easy for people not there to think that you would have done, but I was kept so busily occupied there. In fact, it was one of the most interesting staff jobs I ever had. It turned out in the end.
It sounds like you had a great deal more variety there.
There was a lot of variety.
Anywhere else?
Yeah, I learnt so much there. Of course, you were dealing with civilian governments and police and all the organisations of voluntary organisations, as not only in one country but in several. So you were doing all the things which a large headquarters would have done with a staff about 10 times your size, but you were doing a lot on your own. Mine, the brigadier had a large say of what was going on and laid down the law, of course. But I had to do all the donkey work and meet a lot of these people. And it was very, very interesting indeed. It was quite I think earlier I was a little bit concerned when I got this posting that I should have been going east and not west. But then I came to the conclusion, as everybody else did at that time, that the garrison, which was the force which was going to Korea, was small in comparison. And there wasn't room for many people out there. And if they wanted you, they'd call for you, as I was in the end, but not able to go. So I think we stayed there for a bit. And then my father had now moved to Norfolk. He'd been down in Kintbury in Berkshire before, where he'd been the vicar, I think it was there. He then moved to Norfolk. I don't ask me why he moved from one parish to another, but he'd been 10 years in Berkshire. I suppose he reckoned that there was nothing new to be gained there. So they went to Norfolk and took over the parish of Hingham, which was 14 miles west of Norwich. Now, remember, we were still in the winter now, and we motored up there, and they'd moved into this huge Georgian rectory. It was so big that they really couldn't furnish it all. The three stories. There was the top one, which obviously in the old days the servants used to live in. And then there were the main bedrooms on the next floor down, and then the living area and the kitchens and so forth on the ground floor. As a matter of fact, there weren't all the number of rooms, they were just big. Mm. Big an area with large windows, and it was a lovely place to live in. And a huge garden, 2 acres, I think, a garden, which included a nut tree walk, where you walk down with these trees on either side with various nuts and walnuts, chestnuts, and all kinds of other nuts. And there was a big walled kitchen garden there, growing apricots in the niches on the wall. Luckily, of course, a parson isn't well paid, so he found it a bit difficult to keep it up. But there was a big stable yard with accommodation there. So what they did was to have a couple live in, which they didn't have to pay anything for. And in return, the bloke did the garden and odd jobs around the place. and his wife came in and gave a hand in the kitchen. No, she didn't, actually. We had Mrs. Can't remember her name now. Typical old Norfolk dear. She used to come in and clack at the Christopher in his pram and say, call him a little old dear, you know. So it worked out quite well, actually, but they had enough furniture for the floor down below and a couple of two or three bedrooms upstairs, but it was a bit sparsely sort of furnished. But the drawing room was beautiful, with this great big fireplace. Of course, in the old days, I mean, the parsons came from rich families, so they expected to live in conditions into which they were accustomed, and they brought with them money so they could keep it up. But as time went by, it was less and less, and although at some stage, going back in our family, we did have money, I don't know where it went. as I said, my father's father was a parson as well in the city of London, and we have bishops and so others in the family. So there wasn't an awful lot, there was no spare cash about the place. So he had to live on his
stipend.
Stipend, yeah. So he managed all right with this arrangement.
Did you go on the course at the School of Infantry?
Yes, I did. But I just want to mention one thing. We went up there and stayed with my people up in I think we had a month's leave. Mm. And it snowed very heavily there. And I came up after we'd been there for a couple of days and found the poor old minks outside of the radiator bust. Of course,
bad luck.
I hadn't thought about it.
You hadn't thought about antifreeze.
No, well, it wasn't antifreeze in those days. Yeah. You just had to drain off at nights.
Yes.
I don't think antifreeze had come in there. Certainly when I was with my regiment, in the cold weather, we had to drain off all the vehicles at night, refill them in the morning. So that was something I remembered there. Also, the other thing is, I think the weather got much better. We were there quite some time, I think. Because I remember my father baptized Christopher in the church there, and I can remember a picture in my mind of him walking across the grassy area between the rectory and the church with Christopher in his arms, walking across the grass there when it was clear of snow, and it couldn't have been all that cold because people weren't wearing any sort of overcoats or anything. So then, I went on this course at the School of Infantry. We moved down to Heytesbury, which, as you may or may not remember, was where the battalion was stationed when we were doing the demonstration battalion at the School of Infantry. Heytesbury Nook Camp, it was called.
That's right.
And I think there was probably the School of Infantry battalion was still there when we went.
Yes.
But there was a little flat in Heytesbury, which had been hired by the army, which we moved into for 3 weeks during the course.
Do you remember if the course taught you anything which you hadn't already covered and didn't know?
I think it was refreshing. I can remember I got good marks at the end of it, which I should have done. I mean, if I hadn't got good marks, I ought to have been. I wasn't very clever to get good marks, considering I'd been commanding companies since 1941, and I've been on active service commanding a company. There wasn't an awful lot more they could teach. I mean, you can always learn.
Of course.
You can't go onto a course and say, oh, I know a lot.
Yes. I was wondering if there had been any significant changes in the way in which a company would be handled between your command in wartime and this course.
No, I think there was, as far as I can remember, whereas before the Second World War, we were still living off the First World War up to a point. I mean, mobility had come into it a bit.
Yes.
We were still lunching off the Second World War, I think, at this stage still. And it went on for some time because manoeuvre had returned. And the use of air, tanks, all in combination one with another, had been thoroughly exercised during the Second World War.
Yes.
And was the sort of basis on which wars were fought in the future. I mean, okay, when we got to the Gulf War, it was all air to start with, in the hope that you could knock the enemy out and you wouldn't have to do any fighting. But
Well, and the infantry were all riding in armoured vehicles. That's not.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Presumably hadn't happened by 1954 when you were doing your company commander's course.
No.
That came later, the mechanisation.
I think so, yes. I'm trying to remember. No, they were still riding on the backs of tanks on the battalion demonstration that was given. I mean, I did attend company commanders' courses during the war as well.
Yes.
But of course, they weren't tailor-made. They weren't made state of the art, I think is the expression today, as they would have been at Warminster, which is the School of Infantry, because
they were divisional battle school courses.
They were no. They were company commanders' courses, as opposed to battle school courses, but they were. They were based in houses which had been taken over in the country.
Yes.
You didn't have a squadron of tanks on hand, as you do in the School of Infantry. You didn't have the ranges. You didn't have the same opportunities as you have at the School of Infantry. And, of course, they had, at the School of Infantry, they'd obviously worked on very hard on what the basis and what they were going to teach and the techniques and everything. And they had all the backup that was needed.
Yes.
Whereas the ones during the war were very much more ad hoc. I mean, they were very good. They'd been put together very quickly. But a lot of the instructors were fairly new to the job, and they had to pick it up.
Or improvising as they went
along.
Yeah.
But we had toots and outside exercises and patrolling, as we used to do there, just the same. But, of course, this was more along the lines of professionalism. So yes, I must have learned. I mean, I'd been stupid if I'd gone in the course and not tried to learn something out of it.
But also, you've been involved in laying on such courses, haven't you, when you've been in demonstration battalion down there earlier on?
Well, we've taken part in them.
Yes,
yes, that's true, yeah. We provided
troops. You were effectively a gamekeeper turned poacher.
Yes, yes. Yes, or perhaps it was the other way around. I was a poacher, come gamekeeper. But, no, I obviously learned. And was refreshed of things I'd forgotten and were reminded of. It was very useful. And it was very pleasant because I had the family down the road in a little flat. And I remember the weather, this must have come a little. I don't know quite how things worked out, how long we stayed up at Hingham, when the course... I think the course came in April.
Yes.
Because the weather was so much better, or started perhaps in March and went on into April. Because I remember we used to go up on the Wiltshire Downs on the weekends and have picnics up there now and again. Once or twice probably we did it. But we wouldn't have done that if the weather had been... bad. But anyway, I suppose at the time when I reported to the depot, I must have got the news that I wasn't going to the 1st Essex after all, and that I'd been ambushed, as I put it, by the depot, and I was going to stay there as training major. Well, that was what the title was given to me. I don't know whether they always had a major doing it. But I think by that time, of course, they were still in Korea at that time, but the war had finished, and I presume that the vacancy which existed for me had been filled.
Yes.
So there wasn't any point in my going out anyway, probably at that time.
What was the job of training major, and what were your main functions?
Well, training looked after everything to do with the recruits in their training when they came in for when they passed out.
So this is basic training.
The syllabus, yeah, basic training. The syllabus was already written up. I mean, it had been going on for years as to what... You had to look at the end product. What did you want to produce?
Yeah.
There was no way you could produce a trained soldier from the depot training. You could teach them arms drill, you could teach them foot drill, you could teach them field craft up to a point, use of ground. You could teach them a little bit about organisation of what they were going into, because they needed to know where what their place was in the overall outfit. But of course there was a lot more than that when they first came in, because they were raw material. They were national service, a lot of them at that time. But they didn't get any special treatment, because we felt it was wrong to give pussyfoot them, and then they went to the battalion when they were expected to take their part as a soldier with the rest of it, with everybody else. So they got no quarter, but at the same time you had to have a thought at the back of your mind that these were guys who were pulled out of civilian life, not necessarily against their will, some came willingly, but from jobs which they had to give up, from the fact that they might have just been going to get married and couldn't, or just got married and didn't want to leave their wives. Others who wanted to go on to further education, although there were exceptions made for people who
could defer.
Mm. But by and large, they came in as a blank sheet. Mm. Many of them have misconceived ideas as to what was in store for them.
What sort of misconceived ideas?
Well, they thought it was all going to be terribly rough, you know, and everybody was going to be shouting at them all the time, and they were going to have a hard time, and physically they didn't wonder whether they were going to be up to it, and you know, all kinds of. I can understand a feeling of a little bit of apprehension of people coming in who weren't expecting to go into the army at all. I mean, it's one thing to volunteer and then say, all right, I'm prepared to put up with everything. I like the idea of going into army and testing my mind and my physical ability and everything. And other people have just been pulled out of their jobs who never thought about it.
And thrown in at the deep end.
And thrown straight in, especially they came in the infantry. Mm. Now, of course, those who went off into other services, a lot of them wasted their time, and I think this is where the national service sometimes gets its bad name, for people who came in for 2 years and wasted 2 years of their life, as they said, because they weren't put to proper use. If somebody's going to give up their job or come into civilian life and do something they didn't want to do, they've got to be made to feel that they're doing something worthwhile. It's made worthwhile that they're for their own sake and for the sake of the country. But if they go into some of these service units where apparently they weren't made use of properly, they were put on sort of fatigues and whitewashing things that didn't move and saluting things that did move, as the expression was in those days, and then they came out thoroughly dissatisfied and they got a lot of publicity. Mm. And there was a lot of, as you know, expression going around that there had been wasted people's time. But we didn't find that for the ones who came to us, anyway.
I was going to say, did you find that there were recruits who turned up who were not really fit for training, who had to say?
Oh, yes, there were some who obviously had to be got rid of and sent away. There were some who were physically not up to it. There were some who obviously weren't what was called amenable to discipline in any way. But there were very, very few. Mm. Because discipline in the schools and at home in those days was still pretty good. And most of them are still wearing boots, I think, in those days. Certainly pre-war, all the chaps who came in had boots. So there wasn't any problem with feet. A lot of them have been doing manual work anyway and were fairly fit. Now, of course, we've got a different type of person coming in now. So, first of all, we had to explain everything to them. They had to explain, first of all, they had to be fitted up with their uniforms and shown how to put them on, how to use them, how to wear their hat properly, how to wear everything, belts, equipment, how to put it on, how to put it together, how to take it to pieces, how to clean it, how to blanco it. Funny, we used to call blankoing when you put khaki uniform, but that must have gone back to the old days.
When
it was white, and they still talked about blankoing.
But in the Guards, they talk about buff equipment, which is in fact whitened.
Buff
equipment.
Yes.
Like whitened.
Well, we used to talk about buffing things up.
Yes.
Yes. But yes, go on.
I was going to say, did you make any sort of changes in the syllabus or the way in which it was delivered while you were running the machine at?
I probably made some adjustments, more to suit the NCOs who I had probably,
yes.
I had to get around and find out the capabilities of all the instructors, as whether they were doing the right thing and whether they were up to the job, which meant that I spent a lot of my time when I first got there going round and listening to what was going on.
It's not an office job, is it?
No, it wasn't an office job. But I was just getting around saying that there's a lot more we had to do with these recruits before we could even put them on parade.
Yes.
They had to explain their rights, the Army Act. They had to be explained to them that they were bound to obey officers and NCOs' orders, even though they didn't like them. And if they wanted to complain about it, they had to carry out the order and then complain afterwards. But not to complain too often, because they become whingers. They have to accept hard, the rough and the smooth. We had to explain that they were going to get called on fatigues, and they were going to get called on spud peeling, carrying coal around the place, cleaning out the lavatories, going into the mess and help with the preparation of food generally, and cleaning up in the canteens and dining rooms and so forth afterwards. Everything had to be explained to them. Then the regimental history, up to a point, I mean, it didn't go into the whole thing, that they were coming into a family which had been going for 300 years, and explained to them that people over those 300 years had gone out, fought, died, wounded, and done their bit for the regiment and their country, and they were joining something which was not just an ordinary civilian company outside, which they'd been used to, but they were coming into something which had been going for years, and that everybody was expected to live up to the traditions of the regiment and its past.
Who actually did that instruction in the regimental history?
I did all the talking to them. I didn't do all the bits about equipment and stuff. That was done by the NCOs.
How far back did you go then, to the foundation of the regiment?
Well, I used to go right back, yes, but it didn't take long. I mean, it's just sort of just the milestones.
An introductory.
Yes,
sketch.
And the fact that how we got our battle honours and this, and then the regimental colours, and how they came about, and then explain. I think I gave them some outline. Idea of what a battalion consists of, because that was where they were going, so they had to know what they were being trained for to fit into the battalion.
How many of them did you have in an intake, and how often did they come in?
I wish I could remember. I can't remember. I think the courses were fairly long at that stage. I mean, in wartime there were 6 weeks, I think, but I think we were down to 2 or 3 months now, not more than that.
What about your NCOs? Were they given a preliminary training before they were set to instruct recruits?
Well, they were selected from the regiment, from the battalions, as being the best that could instruct.
Yes.
Which were very reluctantly given up by the COs. But then they came to the depot. They had to go through an introductory course themselves, which really meant, first of all, a lecture on what was expected of them, and then they would then go round with the other NCOs already there and watch them doing the job. And then they had to be passed out, first of all, before they could actually take over.
So they were doing a sort of Carter course.
Well, you see, we didn't have the resources to put them all into. I mean, the changeovers came one at a time. I mean, an NCO would have his time expired in the depot. I don't know how long they were there for, probably 2 years. And then there was his time to go back to the regiment or get posted somewhere else. So we had to get one other to come in.
So would this be learning by observation?
Yes, more by observation and by instruction by the NCO who was on the job. He'd tell him, he'd answer his questions. He would then go through it with him after the particular lesson which was being taught at that time. But a lot of it he would know already, because he'd be doing it in the battalion anyway. I mean, when the recruits had finished at the depot, they then went to the battalion, where actually it would take, I always estimate, take a year to make a trained soldier.
When they left the battalion, you were saying that they'd learned some basic soldierly skills. Do you think that when they left the depot to go to the battalions, they had a military mentality, or did that come later?
I think they were able to, they got to the stage where they were able to conform without any difficulty. Their original nervousness of coming in had been sort of gone. They had got there's a comradeship developing between them, and when you get all a whole bunch of people like that all undergoing the same trials and tribulations, then the comradeship deepens and they get to know each other, and that was something which they enjoyed, which they hadn't had in civilian life so much, was the comradeship and the jokes about when they came off parade, about what happened on parade. They'd joke about somebody who'd done something or whatever, and then they'd start getting nicknames. That was a great thing in the army, was a nickname. If you got a nickname, you were home and dried. But I don't think, I wouldn't say they got military, what was, I'm sorry.
The military spirit. I mean,
the military spirit, I wouldn't say entirely up to then. I mean, they had to really get into an organisation like a battalion, which was actually out doing things rather than being trained up for it.
Had they done any sort of collective training, any tactical training when they left?
No, it was all individual.
All individual.
It was mostly individual, as far as I can remember. They were taken out on the ground, but it was all individual field craft. Sighting of weapons up to a point, because that's all part of camouflage. Judging of distances, I think, came into it, you know.
Estimating and bracketing.
Yes, that's right.
Did you have a training area on which you could...
Yes, we had the Worley Common behind us, which we went out. Quite a large area, actually. We also had a 30-yard range for full bore firing on there, and we had a 2-2 range. Mm. So they did do some 2-2 shooting, and I think they did some full bore at the end. I can't remember whether we got them up to that stage. Mm.
They wouldn't do a musketry course for you, though, would they? No.
But, of course, they all started off drilling without weapons at all.
Yes.
Initially.
Foot drill and then arms
drill. Foot drill. And then once they got used to reacting to commands instinctively, which was the whole idea of drill, of course, then they got their weapons. And then they all had to be explained, all the bits and pieces.
Naming of parts,
yes, that's right. I mean, everything we took for granted in the army had to be explained to them, bit by bit, until they absorbed it. And of course, some of them more intelligent than others. Some of them were very intelligent, coming from different backgrounds. Others were a bit slower in the uptake. So, you know, it was a grind getting it in. But then, I think I also had powers of company commander as well, because I can remember taking company office.
Was that busy? Did you have a lot of trouble?
No, because we didn't put people on charges at that stage. And they got a good talking to and a dressing down. Maybe they came up to get a dressing down.
Yes, I was going to say, would that be done mainly by the NCOs? Or would you
well, they're certainly on parade and off parade they'd be done. But yes. If they got an exceptional case, they wanted somebody in my position to put a bit of steam on. If they came up to me, or any sort of person of my rank, they realised that the seriousness of the situation more than perhaps they would have done if they'd just got it from the sergeant. But there wasn't an awful lot of that. I mean, they were all pretty well complied, as far as I can remember. I don't remember any problems of any great... I remember one or two coming up, which I had to sort of give the... read the Riot Act too. That was more out of ignorance, I think, than willfulness.
Well, they just didn't understand.
You got, and then in which case you had to be sort of fatherly to them more and explain to them, look, you can't do that, you know.
Did you have any officers on your team as instructors?
I had a couple, I think, yes.